Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile. Today, I'm standing on Westbourne Terrace in Paddington, W2. One street north of the stabbing of PC Jack Avery. Three streets west of Alice Williams' death. Two streets east of the attack on Airman Stanley Thurman. And one street south of the curse of the castrated flasher. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Since construction began on the station in 1852, prostitution has always been part of Paddington's seedier side. There's not a single flat which hasn't been used by sex workers to service their clients. Only now, many brothels are rented out by Airbnb, with their transactions taking place via an app. So as easily as you may order a McMuffin at Mucky Doo's, someone has ticked blowy from a drop-down box, swiped right for a hand shandy, clicked yes for dogging, added a smiley face for S&M where the safe word is Gerald, and God help anyone who mistakes the pint emoji for the poo. Back in the 1950s, Flat 7 at 32 Westbourne Terrace was a simple, small, fourth-floor lodging comprising of a single room with a bed, a sink, a sofa, and a small kitchenette. Rented out to Ruby, a 35-year-old prostitute, and Ernest, her husband. This is where she'd have sex with several men each night for cash. Having driven her to and from the flat to a known pick-up point, at 12:45 a.m., on Saturday the 14th of January 1956, Ernest would claim he last saw Ruby alive as she entered a taxi with an unidentified man. 7 hours later, he would stumble across the body of his wife, having been brutally murdered in her bed. As her pimp, who was flat broke, the only other person with a key to the flat, and a laughable alibi that she was due to meet a man no one had seen, who he knew only as the bearded man. As the police's chief suspect, Ernest was questioned on suspicion of her murder. But was this the truth or a lie? My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 187, The Bearded Man, Part 1. The most startling detail of this case is the relationship between this husband and wife, Ruby and Ernest Bolton. It beggars belief why a couple who had married out of love would make such a seedy deal in which she sells her body to a slew of horny strangers as her spouse counts the cash and waits to drive her to her next customer. But as odd as it may seem, it's a lot more common than you would think. Ruby was born Robina Pattinson in the summer of 1920 in the city of Carlisle, just shy of the Scottish-English border. we know little of her early life. As even to those who know her, she spoke little of her past. Whether by abuse or abandonment, Ruby always seemed to be running away from something. As a gorgeous girl with a cheeky face, short dark hair, and bright red lips, whatever or whoever she was fleeing from was hidden by a personality which beamed warmth and love. Being well-liked, Ruby made a way in life by being sweet, polite, and nice. And as a woman who would make a living off her looks, even when she was broke, she never went out without her hair coiffured or her nails painted. Receiving a basic education and living in a city thick with the dark, sooty plumes of industry, where as a woman her options were limited. By the 25th of June 1938, 18-year-old Ruby had moved 92 miles south to the seaside town of Blackpool, where she married a 41-year-old butcher called Richard Moore. Living in a little flat above a butcher's shop on Russet Avenue, they lived a simple life, but it lacked love. In early 1940, Ruby gave birth to a baby girl, believed to have been called Jean. But even the prospect of a long life with a loving family of her own making couldn't hold this little threesome together. As the German bombers of the Second World War pummeled the surrounding cities of the north, Ruby became a prostitute. Why? We don't know. But it's easy to slip into the Victorian myth that all sex workers were fallen women, whether drunks, druggies, the deranged or the destitute. Of which some were, but others were not. The 1940s saw a huge upsurge in everyday women, supplementing their meager income, often half of what a man earned for the same job, through sex work. For some women, the simple exchange of a meal, a few drinks, and a hotel room for the night, in return for sex, wasn't prostitution. For many mothers, sex was a noble sacrifice for some extra cash or ration stamps to feed their family when life was hard. And for some women like Ruby, given a choice of a pittance washing crockery, or a decent wage wanking off maybe 10 men a night, at 3 minutes a time and earning more per hour than they could per day, it wasn't a hard decision. Prostitution gave them power, money, freedom, and control in a world where they had none. Ruby was her own woman, who worked the hours she wanted, when, if, and how she decided. And although it gave her a better standard of living, as it often did, it caused havoc with her home and family life. Whether her husband knew, colluded, or was oblivious to her activities is unknown. But in 1946, after 8 years of marriage, Richard and Ruby separated when she was convicted of brothel keeping and child abandonment. On paper, it sounds abhorrent. But given that her crimes were recorded by religious zealots, child abandonment was a common offence attributed to many working mothers. And any property could be classified as a brothel if two prostitutes and a maid were together in the same room, even if they weren't soliciting for sex at the time of their arrest, but were simply having a cup of tea. Deemed by the courts as a bad mother, Ruby lost custody of her daughter. And again, as was the way, she ran from her troubles and moved 240 miles south to London, where she met Ernest. Her husband, her pimp, and the man who would be questioned on suspicion of her murder. To those who knew them, the relationship between Mr. and Mrs. Bolton seemed like any other. Raised and living in Lewisham, South London, 35-year-old Ernest Joseph Bolton earned a living as a driver. And having met Ruby 1 year before, they married at a registry office in May 1947. Being of a similar age and outlook, they seemed well suited. But their nuptials got off to a rocky start when their marriage was declared null and void, as Ruby was still married to Richard. Divorced, she remarried Ernest on the 21st of June 1949, and they lived in the heart of Paddington's Red Light District. On paper, his job was as a driver who owned his own firm called Ruby Car Hire. But making his money as a pimp, it's likely that this was to hide their immoral earnings under the guise of a taxi firm. Between 1951 and 1956, Robina Bolton, known as Ruby, was convicted 22 times for soliciting, with Ernest fined £40 and 10 guineas in 1952 for managing a brothel. Unlike her ex, there was no denying that Ernest was a key part of Ruby's life in the sex trade, as for at least the last 6 to 8 years, when she was having sex, he was never more than a street away. Little is known about Ernest or his ways, whether he was violent, coercive, passive, or protective. As with prostitutes, there are many types of pimps. Some are nothing more than aggressive bullies who drug, beat, and abuse their girls into shadows of their former selves. Some use the old ploy of love to coerce a fleet of lonely ladies into believing it's only him who loves them. To some, it's just a business which they've set up together, with the wife doing the sex and the husband as protection. And whereas some are passive underlings, who do their wife's bidding as a bodyguard and a maid. How it was split between Ruby and Ernest may never be known. But as an independent woman, with a shared bank account, both names on their flat's contract, and with her deciding how many hours she worked and which clients she saw, it's possible that she set the rules and he did the driving. Mr. and Mrs. Ruby and Ernest Bolton lived in a small rented flat on Porchester Place, a side street between Sussex Gardens and Edgware Road in Paddington. As a little piece of home where they ate and slept, no sex work ever occurred under this roof, as they kept both sides of their lives separate and distinct. As two sides of the same coin for many years, they had their routine finely tuned and running smoothly. Waking at 10 a.m., their mornings to mid-afternoon was theirs to do with as they pleased. At 7 p.m., they ate dinner in the home they shared. At 8 p.m., having dressed, they went to the flat to change the sheets, to freshen the air, to empty the ashtrays, to stock up on tea and milk, as everyone needs a brew. They would pop on the fire to make it cozy, the lights to keep it safe. And when needed, she replenished the stash of erotic magazines she kept in the flat, in case any client had issues downstairs. It was also a neat trick, as by letting him flick through some saucy photos, half of her job was done before she'd even got undressed. Aiming for a 15-minute turnaround per client, sex work is all about efficiency. By 8:30 p.m., Ernest would drive Ruby to the corner of Hartford Street and Park Lane in Mayfair, a well-known pickup point for West End prostitutes in the shadow of some of London's poshest hotels. As her pimp, he would either wait nearby or would circle about, watching out for any passing policeman. In her purse, she carried just enough money for the cab home, condoms of several sizes, and business cards with her phone number on, Ambassador 2385, as well as the name R. Bolton and Plummer, just in case any punter's wife got suspicious. Having done the circuit, if she had already gone or he'd seen her pick up a punter, he would discreetly follow the taxi back to the Paddington flat and wait until she was done. The routine was always the same. First, he would park his car in Gloucester Terrace and wait for her to exit the flats by the side door. Second, when the sex was taking place, she would leave the curtains ajar and the lights on, so he knew when she was done. And third, if she was running late, he would call the phone in the flat from a phone box on either Calworth Street or Spring Street to check if everything was okay. Having driven her several times back and forth from Westbourne Terrace to Park Lane, and made £20 to £30 a night, roughly £500 to £800 today, they would usually finish up by 2 a.m. But as did happen on occasions, some regular clients would pay to spend the night with Ruby, which was easy money. It may seem odd, but that's how it had been for Ruby and Ernest for many years, until things started to go wrong. Friday the 13th of January 1956 was typical of the days leading up to her death. As with many couples when money was tight, tempers frayed over the smallest of things. That afternoon, Ruby and Ernest went to the Paddington branch of the Midland Bank with a sense of dread. Their joint account had a balance of just 12 shillings and threepence. Four cheques to the tune of £420 in today's money were set to bounce, and a loan of £12,700 today was increasing daily. Even the basics had become a struggle. The car tyres were bald, the tax was out, the cupboards were bare, and having fled their flat in Porchester Place with the rent unpaid, 2 days after Christmas, they had moved into flat 7 at 32 Westbourne Terrace. A small, fourth floor lodging, barely 15 feet wide and deep, with a sink, a sofa, a bed and a bath, where every night, Ruby would have sex with men, for cash. No longer was their home life and sex work separate, as now it all took place under the same roof. His roof, as by the time he would return home, his still warm bed, his now soiled sheets, and his ever faithful wife were sullied by another man's smell, having violated his bride as he had waited patiently outside. After the bank, although broke, Ernest drove Ruby to a hairdresser's on Edgware Road. This may seem like a luxury, but as a woman whose lifestyle depended on her looks, it was as vital as buying petrol. having waited nearby. At 4:30 p.m, Ernest drove them back to the flat, where, as per usual, they changed the bedsheets, freshened the air, emptied the ashtray, stocked up on tea and milk, and with the erotic magazines a little light, Ruby set aside £1, as she had a contact with a fresh dash of porn. With a few hours to spare, they popped on a small fire to make it cozy, a little light as the winter night drew in. And according to Ernest, they ate their final meal of wild duck, roast potatoes and green beans. A posh meal for a broke couple, which was gifted by an amorous client, as later verified by her autopsy. For almost 4 hours, Ruby and Ernest were alone in their little flat, and not a single sound was heard by the neighbours through the wafer-thin walls. And having dressed, just shy of 8:30 p.m, they left. Her final night alive was just like any other. At 8:30 p.m, Ernest dropped Ruby off on the corner of Hertford Street and Park Lane in Mayfair. To keep himself busy, Ernest would either patrol the streets looking for police, visit pals for a chat, or do a circuit in the car from Park Lane to Piccadilly. Maybe as much as a distraction from the acts his wife was engaged in. By 8:40 p.m, as she had gone, he drove back to the flat and waited in his freezing car on the corner of Gloucester Terrace and Craven Road. Within sight of the side door, the open curtains, and the single bulb shining bright. As inside, on his bed, a man he had never seen nor met rammed his cock inside his wife. With it being improper to disturb Ruby when she was doing the business, he never entered the room when she was working. Besides, he couldn't, as he only had a key to the flat and not the communal door. At 9:10 p.m, a little later than expected, as her first customer of the night, a man unseen by Ernest had issues getting Percy Perky. Ruby returned to the car, having made £4, roughly £100 today. According to Ernest, she was her usual self. She made no complaints, and the two drove back to Park Lane to pick up another punter. At 9:30 p.m, Ruby picked up her second customer. The seedy little routine began again, and although it's unclear how much she earned from this client, it varied from between £3 to £5, depending on what things he wanted to do to her. At 10:15 p.m, she picked up her third, a man only partially seen by Ernest. But having returned to the flat at 11 p.m, he saw that the lights were off and the curtains were drawn. With it not uncommon for Ruby to pick up a man between clients, or as many prostitutes did, to pay taxi drivers a little extra to turn a blind eye so they could nosh off a randy man in the dark of the back seat, saving time and money. Ernest waited 30 minutes, rang the bell, but got no reply, and returned to Park Lane at 11:40 p.m, where he saw her, although she never said where she had been. At midnight, Ernest saw Ruby get into a taxi with a man he described only as a little guy, who was a bit too quick to come and paid her £2, making her night's takings as much as the average weekly wage. With her finances dire and debtors circling, Ruby had 2 hours at best to claw in as much money as possible. And although this pickup spot in the poshest part of Mayfair was surrounded by five-star hotels and exclusive casinos, she rarely bagged herself a rich man with oodles of cash to flash. But as a pretty and pleasant girl, she could rely on her regulars, some of whom liked her and loved her. According to Ernest, based on a brief chat he'd had with Ruby that night, at 12:20 a.m., a client she'd given her business card to had called Ambassador 2385, and he asked to stay with her until the morning, at a price more than she had earned that night. This would have been music to her ears, but having pre-arranged to spend the night with a regular from the West Country, she'd had to turn him down. Ernest didn't hear this call, as he was waiting outside. At 12:30 a.m., during their last ever 10-minute drive from Westbourne Terrace to Park Lane, Ruby told Ernest, I've got someone here all night. I'm sorry, but you'll have to stay at a hotel. Having agreed that he would return to the flat at 6 a.m, but only if the lights were on and the curtains were open, Ernest would later tell the police, I asked her, is it the bearded man? A mysterious client she'd spoken about a few hours before, who he had never seen, met, or knew his name. And she said that it was. At 12:45 a.m, on the corner of Hertford Street and Park Lane, Ernest dropped off his wife of 8 years of marriage to pick up a client for the purposes of sex. In his own words, it was the last time I saw her alive. Where Ernest went over the next 45 minutes is uncertain, as being a lone man in his own car, who was used to keeping an eye out for the police, it's likely he trawled the unlit streets between Park Lane and Piccadilly. And had he passed his flat on Westbourne Terrace, he'd have seen the curtains ajar and the light on until his wife and her client had finished their sex and nodded off to sleep in his bed. Being too late to book in, and given their finances, unable to find a hotel room, he stayed at the home of his friends, Mr. and Mrs. Murden, a solicitor and his wife who lived on nearby Rainsford Street. They would later state he was chatty, neat, and slept on the sofa until just before dawn. The next morning at 5:45 a.m, Ernest left Mr. and Mrs. Murden's home and parked up his car on Craven Street, within sight of the flat's window. At 6 a.m, with the curtains still closed and the light still off, as it was likely she had slept in, he rang the bell to his flat, but he got no reply. As was their routine, at 6:15 a.m, from the call box on Calworth Street, he telephoned his flat, but she didn't pick up. Taking a short walk to give her time to politely get her client to go, from a phone box on Spring Street, he phoned her once more, but again got no reply. Unconcerned for her welfare, he returned to Craven Terrace, and in a local cafe, he had breakfast. An hour later, as witnessed by the tenant of Flat 6, who had heard the phone ringing through the wafer-thin walls for several minutes. Hanging up, Ernest waited outside of the side door of 32 Westbourne Terrace until a passing resident whose bell had rung had opened the communal door. None of the tenants heard any strange sounds that night. Nothing had raised their suspicions. And as Ernest, the lodger of Flat 7, rose the stairs to the fourth floor, there were no signs of disturbance. With his own key, he opened his own door, and he entered his own flat, which he shared with his wife. But instead of the room being light and warm, with her there to greet him, it was cold, dark, and silent. The room was as he had left it 13 hours earlier. No mess, no chaos, and nothing out of place. Switching on the single bulb which hung from the ceiling, in the double divan bed beside the window, he saw the unmistakable figure of his wife. Through the dim light, he called her name.
Ruby!
Only she didn't respond. He called again.
Ruby!
Only she didn't move. And being alone and motionless, with her face in the wall and the bedsheets pulled down, he assumed that she was asleep. Until something made him shiver. Beyond the thick dark clumps of her matted brown hair, up the once white wall by the head of their bed, lay the red spatter of dried blood. Having had her skull caved in with a blunt, heavy weapon. As her pimp, husband, and the last man to see her alive, what he would do next would make him the police's prime suspect. Having failed to check if she was even dead, he went straight to the home of Mr. Murden, his friend and his solicitor. After an hour of legal advice, at 9:22 a.m., it was Mr. Murden who called the police, and not Ernest. The investigation was headed up by Detective Superintendent Joseph Kennedy. To his eyes, the crime scene was as clear-cut as any he had examined. With no forced entry, the victim had either known or trusted her attacker. Being naked and in bed, he had assaulted her, possibly as she slept. With no signs of rape or sexual assault, it was less likely to be a client. With the weapon missing, the murder was almost certainly premeditated. And having been beaten over the back of the head 8 times with a blunt object, her killer had hatred for this woman. As for suspects in the murder of Robina Bolton, a sex worker known as Ruby, the police had only one. A man whose fingerprints were found at the scene. A man whose car was seen loitering nearby. A man who was married to the victim, had prostituted her for money, and whose bank account was grossly in debt. And with the time of her death established as between midnight and 2 a.m. Although he pleaded his innocence, Ernest had a 45-minute gap in his timeline at exactly that point. With a shaky alibi, it was then that Ernest laid the blame on someone he had neither seen heard nor good name. As this mysterious, unidentified client was only mentioned by his dead wife in passing, and who he knew only as the Bearded Man. Part 2 concludes next week.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Was that longer, but that's fine. Blummy. Oh, Christ. Oh, hello, folks. How you all doing? You take your little hat off. There we go. There you are. Hope that's okay. Oh, dear. That was harder to record than expected. Maybe it's because I'm a Londoner. No, because this is a morning. I changed my routine this time. Normally what I'd do is I'd if it's a multi-parter, I'd write one, then edit it. I'd write and record one, then edit it. Write and record one, then edit it. Because I had a little bit of extra time, I thought, let's write both episodes back side by side, which is normal. Kind of makes sense because it's all in your head, but kind of at the same time it's also not the way I like to do it, because normally you write one and then as you're editing you edit out pieces and you think to yourself, oh, I'll put that piece that should have gone in part one, I'll put it into part two, and then if it's not in part two I'll put it in part three. But this time I can't do that, so it's a different system. But there we go. Anyway, that was boring, wasn't it? Right, I'm gonna make myself a quaffy. Why? Because it's morning. It's early morning. Dawn has just gone. Coot has been an annoying little bastard this morning. Really, really getting up to mischief. That's what he does all the time. Little bastard. Cygnets were out. They were having a bit of a fight. The gooses were flying over. The Canadian goose going, eh, as they do. That was my Canadian impression. Right, I'm going to make myself a quaffy. A cup of quaffy. There we go. Way. Gas igniter is playing up. It's not always as good as it should be. Right, let's quaffy in. Two sugars, of course. Pop those in there. Powdered milk. Even though it's nice and cold now, I could actually go for regular milk, but I kind of like my powdered milk. What have I got? I've got a cake. I treated myself to a cake. I'm still trying to be good on my diet, but I'm just not as good as I used to be. What's this one? A Victoria sponge muffin. There we go. Filled with fruity strawberry jam and topped with clotted cream buttercream. I love the way with these things it says serves two. It's like, fuck off. So it's like when you get a nice Battenberg. All Battenbergs are nice. And on the side it says, it's a wonderful thing. It says, one serving is so many calories. It's like they say it's like 140 calories or something like that. One serving. But a Battenberg isn't. It's just a big cake. It's not sliced up. So what is a serving? What is a serving? Like, I'm sure some kitchen boffers looked at it and gone, oh yeah, this sliver is 140 calories. Not for me. A big old chunk goes straight in my gob. Lovely jubbly, 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 jubbly. What's going on here at the moment? Not much. Not much. It's getting cold. Some of the other boaters around here have already got their fires on. I saw something on the forum the other day. They were like, "Who? Oh, who's got their fire on already?" And loads of people going, "Yeah, I've had it on for weeks." It's like, it's not even October. My fire won't go on till December at least. I think you've got to. There's a guy around the corner. He has his fire on all the time, all the time. It's constantly on. And the only day through the heat wave that he didn't have it on was the one day where it topped. It was close to 39 degrees. The day when it was 35 degrees, he had his fire on. Utterly baffling. Utterly, utterly baffling. But there we go. I think that's the difference, isn't it? I guess that's it. If you're Scots-Irish heritage, you're used to the cold. Not like these namby-pambies out there who are like, oh, I need to have my fire on all the time. Like, I wear shorts all the time. Difference between summer and winter clothes. Summer clothes, shorts, T-shirt, normally a waterproof, because you never know. Winter clothes means add a hat and some gloves. That's it. What else is going on? It's all ahead of schedule, which is good. I've been prepping. So this is the two-parter. This will be a break in the sequence. If you're a Patreon subscriber and you listen to Walk With Me, you'll already know that. But there'll be a little break in the sequence because I need to finish the research on the next 8 episodes to take us to the end of the series. All very exciting. Some really, really interesting cases that have never seen the light of day by anywhere else. So when everyone else is doing crappy episodes on Yorkshire Ripper or shite that you've heard a million times that they've got off Wikipedia, these will be some cases that no one's ever heard of, which is brilliant, which is why I enjoy doing them. So, yeah. So I really need to focus on those. So, I'm not taking time off. I'm not doing a new blue. I'm doing something else. I'm doing something different. Just want to shake things up a bit. So I've been having fun with that, writing in my spare time. And they will be coming out after you've heard next episode. So there we go. What else is going on? We've got a Manchester show coming up. I can't remember when this is going out. I think the Manchester show might either be happening this week, if you listen to this, or it might have just gone. A lot of people have said, will you be doing... They've mentioned towns across the UK and places like that and places overseas. Unlikely at the moment. The problem is we're starting with big cities like Glasgow, London, we've done Manchester, and it's difficult to fill those venues. It's not like we're doing Jimmy Carr style venues. These are little venues, and even as of the time we're recording this, Manchester is only an 80-seater and we haven't even half filled that. So the likelihood of us going to remote towns in different places is slim, because if we can't fill a big venue, adequately sized venue in a big city, the likelihood of us filling a little venue in a tiny town is remote. And don't forget, it costs us. I live in London, Adam lives in Scotland, Paul lives in Wales. Three people travelling from three different countries to come and do a gig. So it's we barely break even. So it's unlikely unless we can get the numbers to shoot up. So, yeah. But we got some plans for the future. So there we go. New patron subscribers. So I want to do thank yous to patron subscribers. We've got some new ones. Thank you so much, everyone. Victoria Knowles, Holly Henschk, Amelia Morgan, and Steph Garver, or Gava, should have checked that. I looked and thought Garver, but it could be Gava. I apologise. I hope I got everyone else's names wrong. Right. Victoria, Holly, Amelia, Steph, thank you so much. You're patron subscribers. And don't forget, if you're a patron subscriber, depending on your tier, you get loads of different goodies. You always get crime scene photos. You get the photos I upload, all the videos. If some tiers, you get the Walk With Me, the exclusive podcast that goes out with this. What else is on there? Loads of different videos. I'm about to try and do something new as well. So there'll be new stuff. There's also a competition each month, and you can win kind of a Murder Mile mug of goodies. All you don't have to do anything for it. All you've got to do is say, I want to win. And that's it. So it's worth doing. There's, I think last time there was 40 people submitted to the competition. So the odds of you winning across the year are pretty good. Whew, let's do some quiz questions. Right, as always, I may ball some of these up, but... quaffy. Right, let's go. Question number one. As mentioned at the start of the episode, what are the three nearest murders to this one? So I mentioned three murders at the start of the show, which is nearest to this one. What are they? Question number two. Ruby's married name was Bolton, but what was her birth name? Question number three. Ruby was born in Carlisle, but which recent victim was as recently featured in Murder Mile also came from Carlisle? Question number four. She was married in Blackpool to Richard Moore, but as recently featured in Murder Mile, which couple went on a romantic holiday to Blackpool just days before their suicide? You can tell I'm picking quiz questions that don't ruin the episode because I haven't done part two yet, so I don't want to ruin everything by jumping ahead. Question number five: how many years was Ruby married to Richard the Butcher? Question number six, how many years was she married to Ernest the Pimp? Question number seven, ooh, it's a big question. In the 1940s and 50s, what classified a property as a brothel? Question number eight, in what part of South London did Ruby and Ernest first live? We've got burpees. Ooh, that's not the answer, because I had pate on toast. Nice. Question number nine. Why was their marriage declared null and void? And question number 10, which victim of the Blackout Ripper lived nearest to Ruby's flat? So there you go, we'll do answers to those very shortly. I forgot to say, did I do my This Is Extra Mile unscripted, unedited, blah, blah, blah. You know the drill. It's just in case people jump in at this point and they go, what's this? He seems to have left his microphone on. I don't understand what's going on. Oh, and then they'll go, one star. I would leave naught stars, but iTunes won't let me. They're still my favourite ones. Angry people. I look at a lot of my kind of friends who are other podcasters as well, and they get these all the time, and it's disconcerting when you get negative reviews, but you just got to suck it up all the time and deal with it. But some of them are just really bizarre. I'd never get it. But for me, that it's the one star. I would leave naught stars. It's like, what's the difference between naught and a one? Or as I messaged someone recently, they messaged me to email me to tell me that they were leaving a one star. So I wrote them a really nice email back, thanking them for leaving me a one star, because each star that they add gets me higher up the chain. And I actually said to them, if you would have left me no review, that would have dragged me down. But thank you for leaving me a one star. That's really helped. No reply. Sometimes you got to do it. Sometimes the best way to hit back at someone who's just being nasty for the sake of being nasty is to be nice to them, because there's no recourse from that. Right, let's dive into some stuff. I'm not going to ruin too much, but we're not going to dive into the case at all. We'll just dive into some background stuff. So Ruby, I'm not going to say where she comes from. Her mother's name was Bowman. I didn't mention that in the episode. Lovely lady, brown-haired, well-dressed, always well-spoken. I think everyone called her Ruby, shortening of Rubina, obviously, but she wore red lipstick deliberately, and that kind of accentuated her. 93, almost gave away another question then. Obviously, she moved to Blackpool, which is kind of, 92 miles south of where she was kind of born. We don't know much, but from the research I could do, it's believed that her daughter was called Jean, who was born in the early 1940s. That's about as near as I can nail it down. Unfortunately, this was one of those cases where... when I started going to the archives ages ago, I found this file. I pulled it out. I got some details out of it. I took some pictures, but I didn't have time to look at it enough. And because I was focusing on other stuff, I put it to one side and thought, I'll come back to it. The problem is it's been redacted since. So the file is no longer available. So what that means is that someone, probably a member of the family at some point, has had a lawyer look at it and said, we're worried about the contents in here. Therefore, what the lawyer can do is either redact some of the details or redact the whole file. So the whole file has been redacted. So a lot of these details, unfortunately, I had some of them, but then I've had to work out the rest. Oh, really confusing. So, Ruby and Richard divorced 5th of December 1947, divorced on account of her misconduct. It was kind of, we don't really know much about this case. There wasn't a lot in the press about it. What was known that she was convicted of brothel keeping, but as is one of the questions, brothel keeping, it's a real misnomer in kind of the 1940s and 50s. It's like if you're a policeman could decide that you were a prostitute even if you weren't seen picking up a client. So basically, if a policeman saw a woman who didn't have a chaperone with her, because we're still in the era where women either chaperoned each other or they had to have a man with them. It's that kind of era. If a woman was by herself, that would be seen as odd. Even if you look at the papers in the 1970s, there's a paper that I saw over in Paddington and there's a big furore because two women went into a pub. That's it. That's the story. Two women went into a pub. Two women not accompanied by men, and it was a big old scandal. 1970s. We kind of forget that in our era we still have that kind of shit going on. So, a policeman could basically, if he saw a woman in the same place three times by herself, he could classify her as a prostitute, so therefore she would be convicted of prostitution. Brothel keeping is one of the questions, so that pops up in there later on. With Ernest, he was convicted of running a brothel, but see, technically he is running a brothel because his wife is in there selling sex and he's on the contract with her, so therefore he is running a brothel by default. But if he didn't know anything about it, that's still redundant. He's still a brothel keeper, even though he knows nothing about it. So, yeah, it's a really, really tentative thing. And as for child abandonment, because she was a working woman and because the job that she was doing wasn't deemed to be decent, therefore, if she was leaving her child with a childminder or another prostitute, as tends to be the case quite often, they would work in shifts and kind of look after each other's children, work with them. Therefore, that's classified as abandonment because it would be deemed that the babysitter was not worthy. So so yes, she may have abandoned her child. Yes, she may have been running a brothel. But it's what I've tried to do with this episode is make it clear that not everything is crystal clear. You can't just pin things down and just put a pin in it. It's all very difficult. So, yeah. Ernest Joseph Bolton, as we know, that was his name. Let's see. Let's see if we got some other stuff. They lived in a couple of other flats dotted around. They lived in Jacob's Well Mews in Marylebone for a little bit. The problem is every time that... because she was convicted 22 times, well, she was recorded 22 times of committing solicitation, which is picking up clients. Her last one being on the 29th of April 1954. So that was her last conviction. That was a year and a half before she was murdered. So yeah, they moved around a lot. So it's really hard to pin down. They everywhere was rented, everywhere was cheap, everywhere seemed to be in kind of known prostitute areas. I almost let slip with something then. Not a body burp or a burpee burp, but you know, so I almost said something that gives away the stuff for the second episode. I have to say I have enjoyed writing this episode. It's been an interesting one. I'm not going to give away too much. Things I didn't add into the episode. She had marks on her bottom, a lot of bruising, and that's because she suffered with low blood pressure and often passed out. They tried to kind of attribute this to her murder, but there doesn't seem to be anything that kind of connects them together, so I've left that out. We don't know where they lived on Porchester Place. I've gone through the electoral roll and things like that. We don't know where it was because it was rented and they did move around a lot. So we don't know where their original flat was. But we know that they were definitely in flat 7. Ernest Joseph Bolton, he was described as a motor driver. What else have we got? I know, 35 years old, so almost the same as Ruby. Born in 1920, same year. He'd been a motor driver for a few weeks, and he'd been operating a car hire business under the name of Ruby Car Hire. But there doesn't seem to be any business records for this. This seems to be like a lot of kind of minicab firms where it's a bit of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink, wink. You know this. 22nd of February 1952 at Marylebone Magistrates Court, he was fined £40.10 or 3 months imprisonment for managing a brothel. I've checked more on this because it's one of those minor offences. There's very little reported about it, so it's kind of it is what it is. But he seems to be living either, as the police would state, either wholly or in part of his wife's immoral earnings. As mentioned in the episode, we really don't know much more about their relationship. We don't know what... This is why I've tried to clarify the difference between different types of prostitutes and different types of pimps. We don't know what the relationship was between them. I think there's always a kind of a misconception of prostitutes and pimps that we have this Victorian idea that all prostitutes are fallen women, all prostitutes are on drugs, all prostitutes are alcoholics. All of their pimps are kind of domineering and kind of forcing them forward. But the more I research into these cases about prostitutes and pimps and things like that, the more I'm kind of learning that it's the world that we've been fed by the media over the years and everything we see, especially on these documentaries and shite about Jack the Ripper. Oh, Jack the fucking Ripper. Utter shite. The more that we realise that we're still living in the Victorian era of that kind of mentality, whereas when you start looking at it, that's why I've tried to be more kind of proactive with this, looking at the business side of it, looking at about the relationship between these people. Because if you think about it, if you're a husband and wife and you're she's the prostitute and you're the pimp, are you going to beat her around the face if she's not earning enough money? No, of course you're not, because like that's how you earn your money, by her looking good and a man going, oh, I want to have sex with her. Whereas if you beat her about the face and she's all bloody and bruised, you're not going to earn money. It's like, you know, if you're deranged or you're on drugs, that's what you'll do. But if for many people, if you see this as a business thing, do you know what it was? I'll mention this shortly, but it was the book West End Girls that Paul, one of our listeners, had mentioned a while ago, and it was about a Soho sex worker and her maid. And it's a really fascinating book to kind of, because the maid is kind of new to the situation and she's kind of innocent. She's still a virgin when she gets into this job. She's never had sex. And yet she enters this world of prostitution, and it opens her eyes, because she'd always been told about how, oh, it's dirty and, you know, creepy and, you know, you'll get murdered there. But the more she gets into it, the more she sees the relationships between people and that it's very business focused and that they have routines and they have morals. And, you know, I think it's one of those interesting books where it's never been written, because people are just like, oh, I don't want to know about that. I just want to believe all the Jack the Ripper stuff where they were gin-soddened whores and they deserved to die. You know, I think that's one of the many reasons why I think all the Jack the Ripper shit should go and be flushed down the toilet. It's just utter shit. Oh, have I said that enough? Utter shit. Ernest. He died in 1994 in Gravesend in Kent. We don't know what happened anymore after that. Actually, I'm not going to say any more about that because we've still got next week's episode to go. Their financial situation, so let's try and clarify that. They banked with Midland Bank. Oh, I remember those. I've got my... next to me, I have my dictionary from Midland Bank from the 1980s, and inside it is signed by some of my friends from secondary school. Still got that. They had a joint account. The credit on the account was 12 shillings and 3 pence, which is roughly £12 a day. They'd issued 4 cheques which were due to bounce, one for £11, 11 shillings and 9 pence, which is £210 today. Another for £4, £4, £90. 3 shillings, which is £60. 3 shillings, £3, 15 shillings, and £3, which is about £62. They're my rough estimates on those. So their account was due to be overdrawn by the equivalent today of £420, which is a lot. They'd also taken out a private loan from a friend who was a foreman, and that was for £479, which is today roughly £12,500. So it's a lot of money. They're in a lot of debt. We don't know much about this foreman. We don't know whether he was a kind of criminal on the side or a pimp. We know nothing about him. So they were in a lot of financial trouble. I think that's it. I don't want to go into too much. Let me just see if there's anything that's missing. In her handbag, that night she had her business cards. As mentioned on the business cards was... they were always given out. So you give out your business card, but it wouldn't say, call me for sex work. It would be... So hers was R. Bolton, plumber, and then Ambassador 2385, which was her number. So men who were going out picking up prostitutes... If their wives would go through their pocket, they would see a card and they wouldn't think, oh, he's visiting sex workers. They would all be discreet. So it would all say plumber, carpenter. Some of them were a little cheeky. Some of them would say tool merchant. Very good, tool merchant. In her bag, she had 2 Yale keys as well. One for the outer door, one for the inner door. But as we know, Ernest only had a key to the inner door, the door to the flat. Inside her bag as well was her purse, her makeup, and an envelope in which she placed the money she earned. We're going to dive into the more about the clients next week, the people she met. But she did all right that night. She earned between kind of £2 to £5 per client, depending on what they needed. They would pay for the taxi to and from her flat. If you think about it, even though she's in an area where there is a hotel. Because it's expensive to rent a hotel, it's actually cheaper to rent somewhere cheap like Paddington and then get the man, the client, to pay for the taxi. I think that's it. I don't want to go into too much because next week there's a lot. And next week we dive into all the stuff to do with the murder as well and some other interesting stuff as well. So I'm going to shtum. Let's do the quiz questions. Let's see how many you got and let's see how many of them I ballsed up. Question number one. As mentioned at the start of the show, what are the 3 nearest murders to this one? There was PC Jack Avery, that was over in Hyde Park. Alice Williams, who was the cafe owner, the fight with the lady who was the prostitute. And Stanley Thurman, who was the US airman. Question number two. Ruby's married name was Bolton, but what was her birth name? It was Pattinson. There you go. Question number three. Ruby was born in Carlisle, but which recent victim, as recently featured in Murder Mile, also came from Carlisle? She was Gillian Bennett. In episode 185, recent, Driven to Distraction. That was the lady who bought a Fiat off that weird Eddie Murphy wannabe. Question number four. Ruby married in Blackpool to Richard Moore, but as recently featured in Murder Mile, which couple went on a romantic holiday to Blackpool just days before their suicide? Again, this is from this season. They were Mabel Hill and Herbert Turner, the suicide pact in the Regent's Palace Hotel. Question number five. How many years was Ruby married to Richard the Butcher? 8. Question number six. How many years was she married to Ernest the Pimp? 8. 2 lots of 8. Question number seven. In the 1940s and 50s, what classified a property as a brothel? This was any property could be classified as a brothel if 2 prostitutes and a maid were together in the same room, even if they weren't soliciting for sex at the time of their arrest, but were simply having a cup of tea. I learned this from that really good book that was mentioned by Paul, which was West End Girls by Barbara Tate. Really good book, definitely worth reading, or I think it's on Audible, so you can listen to it. Question number 8. What part of South London did Ruby and Ernest first live? That was Lewisham. Question number 9. Why was their marriage declared null and void? Because she was still married to Richard. And question number 10. Which victim of the Blackout Ripper lived nearest to Ruby's flat? It was... it was Doris Juney. So technically the fourth lady he murdered, but also the last lady he attacked. She lived at the end of... Ruby lived at near the end of Westbourne Terrace, and Doris lived at the end of Sussex Gardens. So they were about 30 seconds apart, if that. Good. So I hope you enjoyed that, folks. This is part one of two. Part two next week, obviously. I always find it fascinating when people go, when's part two coming out? And it's like, I release an episode every Thursday at 4 a.m. I always have done. And people always go, yeah, but what about next week's episode? When's that coming out? It's like, it's next Thursday at 4 a.m. Every episode, Thursday at 4 a.m. Always. Oh, he says, except the ones after this series finished. Change to the sequence, but that's just an anomaly. Right, that's me done. I'm going to have a coffee, I'm going to have a cake, I'm going to go to Costa and do my rough edit of the audio on this. I always go through and clean, get rid of all the mistakes, get rid of all the clicky sounds and all the horrible stuff. That takes about a day. I like the audio to be nice and clean. Nothing worse than these podcasts where people are like, so anyway. Horrible. Right, that's me done. Have yourself a good week, folks. Stay safe and be good. Lots of love. Don't get murdered. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.